forgive or forget.
I must find Dr. Teal, said Fever.
You can't, Fever. Arlo seized her by her thin wrists as she started to turn away. He held her, staring into her face. Be rational. Don't you understand? You can't go back into the city. You must vanish, or you'll endanger us both.
But the children and my friends...
We'll get word to them when they return, I promise.
But you can't stay in Maida. Come with me.
You can help me. Isn't that what you wanted?
Fever, I'll teach you to fly.
Chapter 17. The Ragged Isles.
Boat, she thought dreamily, as the bed she lay on lifted her up and down, up and gently down.
I'm on a boat.
She opened her eyes. She was in a cabin even smaller than her quarters on the Lyceum, and the reflections of sunlight came through a small porthole and patterned the low roof with ripply ribbons of light. The bed went up and down, up and gently down. After Arlo freed her from the rails, he had not led her down the garden to Casas Elevado, as she had expected, but up toward the screes and crags at the top of the crater wall. It seemed the Thursday house had a back exit. A narrow fissure breached the crag, screened by trees, all but invisible. The path that wound through it opened onto empty cliffside on the crater's steep southwestern face. There the Aranya had been waiting for them, motionless and moon-silvery, and Fever tried to tell herself it was a dream, while Arlo helped her down the cliff paths, and the Aranya walked behind, hopping along on its big clawed feet, its shell all spiny like a deep-sea urchin, the joints of its legs whizzing and creaking and squeaking, the gravel of the path scrunching as it set its feet down, the sea booming in the rocky coves below. Not a demon, she thought. A machine. But although she tried to order her thoughts and observe it rationally, she couldn't. She was too shocked and exhausted by her misfortunes. She slept or fainted several times between the cliff's top and the beach, and to her shame Arlo had to pick her up and carry her. He didn't seem to mind. Light as a bird, you are, he said. And then they were on the shore, in a tight little steep-walled secret cove where a boat rode at anchor. It was about 30 feet long, without the beak or stern-castle that boats from Maida usually wore. Fever saw polished wood shining faintly as he carried her aboard. She heard the tick and creak of the Aranya as it withdrew itself into the bushes and the shadows on the shore. Arlo had brought her down the cockpit steps and left her in this cabin, where she had eased herself out of her wet clothes and into this bunk with its clean, crisp covers and woolly, comforting blankets. She had snuggled down and gone to sleep as easily as fern. She sat herself up and looked out of the porthole, but there was nothing to see but sea. The water foamed white along the boat's side, and she realized that it was not at anchor any more. So she stirred herself, despite wanting to go back to sleep. She swung her legs over the bed's edge and pushed herself upright. The swaying of the deck took a little getting used to, but it was not so different from riding the Lyceum over rough ground. She dressed and went to the door and opened it, and climbed up the narrow ladder she found outside it, emerging into sunlight and the crying of angels. The big birds hung all about her, riding the sea wind above the boat and on either side of it. Shadows of them slid over the taut sail, a parallelogram of white canvas that reared high above Fever's head. Away from land and people, the angels seemed less absurd. Their wide wings were made for these empty spaces, and instead of begging for scraps, they were finding their own food, stooping every so often to pluck a shining fish from the wave tops. Fever watched them for a while, wondering if one of them was Weasel, and how she could thank him for saving her.
Fever!
Arlo Thursday was sitting at the tiller at the stern of the boat. There was a blanket wrapped around him, and she had the impression that he had not slept. Behind him, far astern, Fever saw the unmistakable outline of Maida silhouetted against the morning sun. She turned, and there behind a cloud of birds were the Ragged Isles, jutting from their skirts of surf a few miles ahead. "This is one of my grandfather's ships," said Arlo, pushing the tiller over, the boat heeling. "In fact, she's about 7 of them, a bit from one hulk and a bit from another. I rescued them from the wreckers' yards and cobbled them back together. She's called the Jenny Hanover. In the museum at Maida, there are some things that the old sea priests claimed were mermaids. They're bogus, of course, stitched together from halves of monkeys and fish. They're called Jenny Hanovers. And since my Jenny Hanover was stitched together from pieces, too, it seemed a likely name." Fever looked about. Brass rails, oak planking, that towering sail. "Where is the Aranya?" she said. "It will make its own way to the place we're going."
"It can swim?"
"I suppose." In Fever's memory, the Aranya paced down the cliff path, spines agleam, its back-to-front knees glinting as it minced along.
"It is a machine," she said.
"A very old machine. A gift to my grandfather from a grateful client." Fever could guess who the grateful client had been. She had seen things a bit like the Aranya before, in pictures and in the memories that she had inherited from Orrick Godshawk. When the Scriven ruled London, machines like that had been unleashed in Pickled Eel Circus to slaughter their enemies. If her grandfather had kept a few for the Scriven's army, the London mobs would never have been able to overthrow him. But no, he had chosen to squander them all in bloody games with human gladiators, or give them to his friends. "It has a stalker's brain inside," said Arlo.
"It must have more than that," said Fever,
thinking back to the resurrectory aboard Quercus's traction fortress, where she had watched Fern and Ruin's father reborn. "It must have been a person once." "Not quite." Fever glanced at him.
"An angel?"
Arlo nodded. "It is the world's one and only stalker angel, armed with a swift-firing gun. It saved my grandfather and my father many times when their enemies hired the Shadow Men, or the Lords of Pain, to murder them. And in return," thought Fever, "his grandfather had built Godshawk a ship, the Black Poppy, a fast, strong ship that took him north to frozen islands on the fringes of the Great Whiteness, searching for more knowledge of the Stalkers. How he would have loved this voyage," she thought. "The sunlight and the motion of the schooner and the blue salt smell of the sea. It was almost as if he was still there, just beneath the surface of her conscious mind." The Jenny Hanover ran on into the west, with her escort of angels all about her, and the sunlit water foaming down her flanks, and soon she began to pass among the ragged isles. 20 miles to the west of Maida, there had once been a second crater, even bigger, and perhaps created by the same ancient weapon. But perhaps because it lay in deeper water, or was made from different rocks, the wall of this western crater had crumbled to form a loose ring of spiky islands and treacherous shoals. Seeing them from Maida, Fever had taken them to be barren, and certainly they looked sheer-sided and inaccessible. But as the Jenny Hanover sailed between them, Fever saw that there were mats of grass on the tops of some, pine trees and dwarf oak jutting at angles from the cliffs, and on one of the largest, a scatter of ruins. Arlo moved the tiller and the schooner swung her nose toward it, passing through narrow straits between high jagged rocks. Other rocks, almost submerged, broke the sea's surface like black teeth. It felt dangerous, but Arlo seemed sure of himself. Fever started to suspect that the angels who flew ahead of the Jenny Hanover were not just weaving random paths, but were guiding Arlo through those choppy channels. They kept looping back, swooping over the schooner's helm, with raking cries, which the young inventor seemed to understand and respond to, adjusting his course between those slabs and knives of rock. He saw her watching and laughed. "They're really quite intelligent if you know how to speak to them." Some of the looming rocks had been splashed with angel guano in patterns that Fever realized were not as random as they seemed. They lined up with one another to form waymarkers, blazing a safe trail through the maze for anyone who knew how to read them. "There is a good, clear, deep-water channel farther north, beyond those stacks," said Arlo. "Fishing boats from Maida pass there sometimes." But Thursday Island itself is bad luck. Nobody comes near it now.
Young trees clustered among the tall, rocky crags on the island's summit. Lower down, Fever could see the ruins she had glimpsed earlier. Roofless sheds, dead warehouses, the broken stub of a lighthouse on a harbour wall. She remembered the story that Thirza Belkin had told of the wave that had destroyed the Thursdays and their shipyard. It had come from the west, the shockwave from some almighty earth storm in Lost America, rolling clear across the Atlantic before breaking over Thursday Island. It had smashed down buildings and sunk the ships whose dead masts could still be seen jutting sadly from the water in the harbour. Close in against the shore, there were concrete basins, like the pens of a fish farm, where yachts and schooners must once have been dry-docked. The sea had filled them, and all that was left were crumbled, weedy walls that barely showed above the waves. Here, among these ruins, young Arlo had lived for months after all his family were drowned, with no one to care for him but the angels. She would have thought it must hold horrible memories for him, but when she glanced at him, she saw that he looked happier than he had ever looked in Maida. This was a homecoming for him, but not for her. This place made her uneasy. Smiling, Arlo steered the Jenny Hanover into one of the abandoned pens, a shady cave-like space between two roofless warehouses, so overgrown with weeds and small trees that they looked more like cliffs than buildings. A shiver ran through the schooner as her fenders grazed against the rotting concrete. The sail came rattling down, and for a moment Fever thought that they had run aground. But no, it was all deliberate, and there was Arlo springing forward to make fast to a rusty bollard on the pen wall.
"Welcome, Fever Crumb," he said, turning and held out a hand to help Fever ashore. Sand had drifted thickly between the dead buildings. When Fever looked down at it, she saw that it was partly composed of thousands upon thousands of tiny white shells. She imagined the great waves scooping them up off the sea floor as it rolled eastward, depositing them here like payment for the lives and ships it washed away. Arlo pointed inland, up a cobbled hill. "The shipyard buildings are all in ruins, but the old watchtower was here before them, and it's still sound, I think." A metal ladder, orange and scaly with rust, stitched its way up the cliff face behind the abandoned harbour. Three quarters of the way up, a platform was bolted to the rock, like a landing. From there, another ladder rose to the cliff top, where a squat tower perched, dark and unwelcoming, high above the beach. It was very old, a watchtower and artillery emplacement left over from some earlier era.
"Are we going to stay there?" asked Fever.
"Why not? It's good shelter. We're castaways. We can't be choosy."
Fever's unease settled on that word, castaways. Sometimes in the plays of the Electric Lyceum, people found themselves cast away on desert islands. And if there were two of them, and they were male and female, they might bicker for a scene or two, but they always ended up by falling in love. She hoped that Arlo Thursday would not get that sort of idea. The sea nearby stirred into ripples, hummocked and split to disgorge the spiny steel carapace of the Aranya. It stalked out of the water up a flight of weedy steps and stood there dripping, trailing pennants of kelp and bladderwrack, ticking patiently to itself. It looked like a living gun. Had it swum here? Or had it walked, scuttling like a weird crab across all the miles of sandy seabed between this place and Maida? She stood there in the sun and stared at it, torn between disgust at its strangeness and envy of her grandfather for knowing how to build such things.
"Don't be afraid of it," said Arlo, misunderstanding the look she was giving it. "It'll keep us safe. If Vishniak or Fat Jargo find us, it'll see them coming and kill them. Come on now, let's unload."
Chapter 18. The Watchtower. They set up camp in the tower. It had one big room with lime-washed walls and arrow-slit windows and a doorway with no door that opened onto a narrow platform outside, where the ladder came up through a hatchless trapdoor.
There was a fireplace and some broad shelves that might have been bunks set into the walls, and some old tables and chairs covered with dust and angel droppings. Another ladder went up through another trapdoor onto the broad, flat roof. Guns or catapults had been mounted up there once, commanding the northern approaches to the island. But they were long gone, leaving only a few rusty metal mountings set in the stonework. There was a low parapet, crumbling in places, sprouting weeds with pink and yellow flowers that nodded and whispered thinly in the breeze. "This is where we'll build the machine," announced Arlo, peering over the edge.
"In the open?" asked Fever.
"Of course. If we put her together inside, we'll only have to take her apart again to get her up here. This is where we'll be launching her from. It's not as high as the cliffs that Edgar Saraband launched from at Thelona, but it's high enough, I think."
"You think?"
Fever was starting to hate her own scepticism. She knew that risks must sometimes be taken if progress was to be made. But when she went to stand with him at the parapet and looked down to the jagged rocks at the cliff's foot, she could not imagine flying, only falling.
"What if there's more rain?" she said. "What if a storm blows in?"
"The weather will hold," Arlo said. "We only need a few days." Fever hoped that he was right.
"What can I do?"
"The engine," he said. "I know nothing about engines."
"Of course."
She remembered what Dr. Teal had told her about Edgar Saraband's accident. "I'll strip it down and rebuild it. Check every part." Arlo looked sideways at her, squinting in the sunlight. "Fever, I thought I wanted to be alone out here. But I'm glad you're here too."
"I don't approve of mating rituals," said Fever sternly.
"What?"
"Romance. Kissing. Holding hands and that sort of thing. Just because we are on an island does not mean that... The Earth has a perfectly adequate population nowadays, so there is no need for people of reason to give in to the primitive urge to mate and reproduce. I just thought I would let you know."
Arlo Thursday stood and looked at her, and she didn't know whether she had offended him or disappointed him or what. Her ears felt as if they were about to catch fire.
"You needn't worry," he said after a moment. "There's someone else, you see. I'm in love with someone else."
"Oh, good."
"She's called Thirza Blazy," said Arlo. "At least she used to be. She's Thirza Belkin now."
He shrugged, looked away across the ruins for a moment, and then, as if the conversation had never taken place, said,
"We must start getting the machine ashore. I'll need your help with the bigger pieces."
How had it begun, that friendship between Arlo and the Blazes' eldest daughter? Even Arlo wasn't really sure. She had always been there at the Blazy place on Costa Norte, hanging about the yards and slipways, or helping her mother in the house. He had scarcely noticed her at first. But slowly something about her had started to call to him, and make him think it might be time to shake off his solitary birdish moods. It was the tallness and the grace of her, and that calm face that never let you know what she was thinking. She reminded him of the women in the paintings that the sea had stolen from his grandfather's gallery, before it stole the gallery as well. A maiden in a story, waiting at a castle window for the man who'd rescue her. Thirza had no time for the jokes and boldness of Blaise's other apprentices, but she seemed to be amused by Arlo's conversations with the angels. Shyly, he taught her the special call that he used to draw his favourites down from the flocks that flew over the shipyard. He showed her how to hold out her arm so that Weasel could perch on her wrist, and explained the meanings of all his movements. He was delighted by how quickly she learned, and how well she spoke the angel language. Her long neck and slender hands were better suited to their dances than any part of Arlo was. Her white fingers were as delicate as angel feathers. It was not long before Augusto Blazy started to find notes in his daughter's room, scribbled on those dart-like, wing-like things that Arlo made. They seemed to have flown from the boy's window into hers. That made him uneasy. So did the bird shapes Arlo had taken to making and launching from the cliff sides on his afternoons off. stringless kites and paper angels that an unfortunate wind might carry right over the crater crown and down into the city, leading to awkward questions at the Shipwrights Guild.
"That Thursday boy of yours still away with the angels, is he, Blaisy? Don't he know the Mire alone makes flying things?"
It would not do, the old shipwright decided. He would have to break this link of tenderness that he saw growing between Ferdsa and the lad. It pained him, for they were a pretty pair, and he loved his daughter very dear, and wanted nothing but her happiness. But, as he told her, these youthful loves meant nothing. They were only fevers of the heart, and the hotness of them cooled to clinkers after a few years of marriage and a kid or two. Most people never knew that sort of love at all, and took no harm from the lack of it. Far better for Thirtsa she accept the offer he'd had for her from Sharko Belkin, a merchant who wasn't exactly young or exactly handsome, but had grown rich from his contacts with traders in Matapan and other ports around the Middle Sea.
"Love fades," he told her, "but money, if it's tended right, increases and increases, and with enough of it, you can buy happiness, no matter what the poets say. What do poets know about money?"
Ferdsa bit her lip and thought hard. And a few months later, she put on a blue silk gown and stood at the altar in the Temple of the Sea, with half of Maida watching, while fat Sharko Belkin cast the ceremonial fishing net over her, and the High Priestess pronounced them man and wife. Soon after that, Arlo Thursday left Blazes and went back to live alone at Casas Elevado, being old enough by then to decide his own affairs. The city forgot him, except on the days when his strange silent air machines went sliding their shadows over the streets and rooftops. Then people would look up and shake their heads and remind each other of the rise and fall of the Thursdays. It surprised Fever to find how much more capable she was than Arlo. She'd seen the things he'd built and the way he'd steered the Jenny Hanover, and she had assumed he'd bring the same easy skill to everything. But no. It turned out that boats and aeroplanes were the limit of his practicality. She watched in astonishment as he tugged the pieces of his flying machine out of the Jenny Hanover's holds and cabins and started to carry them one by one up the ladder that led into the tower. It was she who had to show him how to rig up a simple hoist, taking ropes and tackle from the schooner and rigging them over the handrail at the ladder's top. She spent the rest of the morning making bundles of the spars and spare timber and tying them securely to the rope's end so that he could haul them up, untie them, and carry them inside the tower. Then there were big bales of paper to be lifted up, and bags of tools, and the unfinished propeller, and the clanking portions of Edgar Saraband's aero engine. Finally, there was a bag of provisions. When Fever looked inside it, she saw that it held only a wheel of cheese, some ship's biscuits, a bag of sugared almonds, and a flask of Thelonan wine. "No flour?" she asked, not quite believing that he expected them to live here on just that. "No butter? Fruit? Water?"
"There's water on the island," Arlo said. "I'll fetch my fishing tackle from the Jenny to catch our meals. And I think there are berries on the western side. There used to be. Anyway, we'll not be staying here long. We'll finish the machine, and when it's ready, I shall fly it back to Maida. It will soar over the city and land on the lawns behind the Quadrado del Mar."
"Orcamo will not like that," said Fever.
"Not many Maidens think like Orcamo nowadays," said Arlo. "My people cling to their superstitions, but they're not stupid. Once they see that flight is possible and understand what it will mean for trade and profit, they will soon take to the idea, just as they have taken to land barges. I'll ask for investors and set up a company. Vishniak and Sharko Belkin will not dare to try anything once I am in the public eye. I'll build a whole fleet of flyers, bigger and better models, able to carry passengers and cargoes." He held out one arm and startled Fever by letting out a piercing cry. With a flap of wings, an angel settled on his wrist. Weasel, guessed Fever, and wondered how long she would have to spend among these birds before she learned to tell them apart, as Arlo did. She couldn't even sort males from females yet.
Arlo was talking to the bird in clucks and gestures, and in words as well.
The house?
Yes.
House?
Said the bird, and took flight. Fever shaded her eyes with one hand to watch him as he soared away over the sea toward the far-off misty cone of Maida. The angels made flying look so easy. You could see why Arlo, growing up among them, might start to think that he could do it too.
Weasel will be our eyes in Maida, said Arlo.
I've asked him to tell us what's happening at the house. If Fat Jago has found those dead thugs of his yet, whether he's looking for us.
Fever didn't answer. She kept watching the angel until he was out of sight. She remembered Fat Jago in the rain last night, saying, I'll find him. She remembered Thatza telling her, there is nothing that happens in Maida that Jago doesn't find out about.
And it was not just Belkin and the Octopus Cartel they had to fear, but the faceless threat of Lothar Vishniak as well. Could they really expect one scruffy seabird to outwit both of them?
Chapter 19. Little Bird. Up went Weasel, high, high, spreading his wings so that the kind warm air above the beaches lifted him. Pitying as he went the poor left-behinds below him, Arlo and Arlo's new young female, with only their feather-naked arms, no wings to loft and carry them, poor nestlings. Carried on the gyres of the air, he reached Maida sky with barely a wing beat. From his height the city looked like a nest, and the harbour a blue egg laid in it. He half-folded his wings and let Earth Tug take him down, spreading them again as all the chimney pots lunged upward at him. He swooped through the city's invisible awning of scents, and the smoke smells and snack smells and garbage smells reminded him that he was hungry. But he knew he mustn't stop. He was wiser than the rest of his people. He was not to be distracted by snacks and smells. Arlo wanted to know things, and Arlo was his friend. So he went to the house, to Arlo's house, which sat in the morning sunlight empty and dead-looking at the bottom of its garden. A sharp scent of carrion drew his eyes down to the two dead men in the garden, crawling with flies in the morning heat. Others of his people were there, hopping about in the grass beside the rails. They were picking up things in their beaks and their fingers, things that flashed and glittered in the sun. Fights broke out now and then, with fierce squawkings and widespread wings, as a new angel arrived and tried to take one of the glittery things for himself. But there were plenty to go around. Little shiny brass tubes they were, open at one end, empty inside, with a smell of fires and smoke about them. Good for decorating a nest, thought Weasel, landing, turning one of the tubes in his wing fingers. He had to remind himself again that he was not like these others whose small heads were full of nothing but snacks and nestings. He was not here for nestings. He was here to be Arlo's eyes. He flew to the house. The door was open. More of his flock were inside, squabbling over scraps in the kitchen. Suddenly, from the trees at the garden's foot, a voice shouted,
Thursday? Fever?
Angels exploded out of the house and rose from the garden like litter in a whirlwind. The alarm calls jangled in Weasel's narrow head. His instincts dragged him into the sky, but instead of fleeing with the rest, he circled there and landed on the house roof, watching as the stranger climbed toward him up the steps.
Fever?
Shouted the man again, thinking that if she was hiding somewhere, she might not have heard him over the screeching of those stupid birds.
It's me! It's Dr. Teal!
There was still no answer. Dr. Teal snuffed the air suspiciously, catching the same sickly scent that Weasel had noticed a few moments earlier. He stooped and picked something up from the grass, a shell casing from some sort of old-tech gun. Going to the rails, he looked down into the trench beneath them and saw what lay there. For a moment, he was afraid that might be what was left of Fever. But then the coverlet of blowflies lifted for a moment, and he saw that the thing had been a man, bearded and brawny, with an octopus tattoo on his arm. Another just like him sprawled among the lavender bushes farther down. The angels had already eaten their eyes.
The Octopus Cartel has been here, Dr. Teal,
Dr. Teal said aloud, covering his nose with his handkerchief and looking at those tattoos.
the octopus and someone else who does not like them and is rather more heavily armed. It was not strictly rational to talk to oneself, but it was a habit that he had. He reached inside his coat and took out the pistol that he had been issued before he left London, holding it ready as he moved on up the steps. The back door of Thursday's house was open. Dr. Teal went inside and moved cautiously through the empty rooms, stooping sometimes to examine a pattern of footprints in the dust and shavings on the floor. "Oh, fever, fever," he said. He went outside again. Best to get away from this place before someone came looking for those octopus thugs. He put his pistol away and ran a hand over his head. 3 days' worth of stubble rasping under his fingers. Just his luck. His message would have reached London by now. The chief engineer was sure to send envoys here to collect the Crumb girl, and Dr. Teal would have to tell them that she was either missing or dead. He went down the steps, looking back once at the sound of wing beats as a lone angel took off from the roof of the empty house. Weasel lifted himself easily over the trees and turned and rose, losing interest in the human, whom he did not know. He would tell Arlo later that the man had been here. For now he was hungry. The hunger was like a little voice inside him pleading for snacks. But he was not going to eat garbage pail scraps and nasty dead men's eyes like those less clever ones. He knew where the best snacks were. Better even than Arlo's. Skimming over rooftops and the crags of the heights, he soared out of the city and slid down the kind sky to where a massive funicular sat among its gardens on the crater's sunny southern slopes. Weasel had another friend here. He called her name as he spiralled down toward the villa's roofs.
Thirza! Thirza!
Everyone misunderstood Thirza Belkin. She knew what they said about her, that she had married for money, that she did not really love Fat Jago, that she was a bird in a gilded cage. Even her best friend said it behind their fans at the lavish, wonderful parties that she gave. She cannot love him. But they had such simple ideas of what love was, little girl ideas, that they had cribbed from plays and stories. Thirza was the first to admit that Jago wasn't pleasing to look on, but what on earth did that matter? He was kind and gentle. At least he was to her, and he was clever, and he was very rich, and her father had been right. Those things meant much more than physical attractions. She loved his wealth, and she loved helping him to make more of it. For it is one of the great pleasures of life to be surrounded by beautiful things and to know that you have earned them. If she ever thought of Arlo Thursday as she lay in her bed, which was as soft as summer clouds, or strolled down her gardens to her private beach. She was far too fine a lady now to let it show. But she was still amused by the angels, and she still talked to them sometimes in the language he had taught her, and gave them things to eat when they visited her in her garden. She was always pleased to see Weasel. When she heard him calling her name that morning, she looked up and waved to let him see where she was, and said to her maidservant, "Bisa, fetch some tidbits for our visitor." The maidservant, a little African girl whose parents had come to Maida as refugees from the Sagwan Empire, set down the kora she had been playing and ran off into the house, while Thirza lazily stretched out her arm for Weasel to land on. He settled on the edge of an ornamental urn instead, and cocked one blue eye at her. "Weasel," she said, "where have you been? It's been days and days." Weasel made a movement that meant fishing, another that meant flying, a third that might have been his birdie version of a shrug. Days meant little to him. One of the first things that Arlo had taught her about the angels was that they had almost no concept of time. The girl Bisa came running back, barefoot, like all the Belkin servants, so that her footsteps wouldn't spoil the pleasant noises of the garden, the whispering ornamental grasses and the wind harps. She was carrying a tray of lovely snacks, little fishy pieces and creamy things in soft pastry cases. Most people couldn't afford such dainties for their children, let alone as gifts for passing angels. Weasel hopped onto the tray's edge and counted the snacks eagerly. One, two, lots. He was very glad that Thirza was his friend.
"And how is Arlo?"
she asked, while he ate the snacks one by one. She sometimes asked him about Arlo, and he saw no reason not to tell her, because Arlo was her friend, too, even though she roosted with the large one who Arlo didn't like. He bobbed and shuffled to make her understand that Arlo himself was roosting with a new female.
"Fevercrumb,"
he said.
"Fevercrumb."
Thetsa seemed pleased. Weasel thought she must be happy for her friend Arlo. He thought that she was hoping his roost would be safe, and Fevercrumb would give him lots of nestlings.
"Where are they?" Thetsa asked him. "Where are they roosting, Fevercrumb and Arlo?"
Weasel told her. He raised his tail and slinked his head forward. That meant Thursday Island.
"Dear Weasel,"
she said, resting her fingertips on the crest of his head as he ate, "will you come back?
Come often and tell me all that Arlo is doing on his island."
"Snacks,"
said the angel hopefully.
"Oh, lots of snacks. But don't tell Arlo, will you? Don't tell him that you talked to me. He would not understand. You promise?"
"Promise,"
said Weasel. He didn't understand either. The ways of Arlo's kind were often strange to him, but he knew they were clever, cleverer than he, and if Thirza didn't want him to tell, he wouldn't tell. Thirza was his friend, and her snacks were even nicer than Arlo's. Fat Jago came home late that evening. Thirza did not need to ask him how he was, or how his day had been. She could tell from the sound of his footsteps as he crossed the atrium that he was weary and frustrated. She sent Beza running for cold drinks and dispatched another servant to the kitchens to tell the cooks to start preparing supper. She rang a bell to alert still more servants, and the house shivered gently and began its long descent toward the foot of the garden, so that the Belkins would have a view over their beach and the sunset sea while they dined. Then she went and settled herself beside her husband and rested her head upon his comfy, upholstered shoulder.
"Bad?" she asked.
Fat Jago stroked her hair.
"Bad. The girls vanished. I blame myself. I should just have had Martino and Splint cut her throat for her last night. But I wanted to do something a bit showy with her. Let people know not to anger the octopus. Now she's gone, and the lads are both dead. Shot to pieces somehow. I've never seen the like. And Martina's got a wife and three kids."
"He had a wife and three kids, I mean."
"It's not your fault," said Thirza. "We'll look after Signora Martino and her little ones, won't we?"
"Of course. But Arlo Thursday's still missing, too. Is the Londoner responsible? Teal? Some of our people saw him nosing around the Thursday place this morning. But he doesn't look hard enough to have taken out Splint and Martino. He's a scholar, not a shooter. I suppose I'll have to bring him in for questioning."
"No," said Thirza firmly. "Teal is London's man, and you mustn't risk offending London. What about all those contracts Quercus has signed with our friends in Matapan? For slaves, steel, copper. If you upset London, the octopus will not be pleased with us."
This was something else that people didn't understand when they saw Thirza with her husband. She was so young and beautiful that they assumed she must have no more brains than one of the charms that dangled from his watch chain. They certainly never imagined that she knew anything of the murkier depths of his business affairs. But Thirza had a sharp mind, and Fat Jago had recognized it right at the beginning of their marriage and shared everything with her. He had not regretted it. It had been Thirza who had first suggested that he make contact with the Octopus Cartel and put himself forward as their agent here at the world's end.
"Anyway," she said, snuggling against him, pleased to be able to give him good news here at the end of his hard day, "I don't believe this horrible Dr. Teal has any idea where Arlo and the girl are. But I do."
"You do? A little bird told me. Arlo has gone back to his island. Fevercrumb is with him. He is going to build his machine there in peace and quiet, alone. Except for the London girl. Maybe he wants her as his assistant, or maybe they are an item. They are certainly strange enough for one another. I'll send a ship to Thursday Island first thing tomorrow, said Fat Shago, all his weariness falling from him as the good news sank in. We'll kill the girl and bring Thursday back to Maida.
No, said Thurtra again.
There is no need. Why shake the tree before the fruit has ripened? We are the only ones who know they are out there. Let them stay. Let them build their machine. My little bird will tell us when it is ready, and then you can go there and collect it.
Fat Shago looked admiringly at her. She was always surprising him. A tiny frown crumpled her perfect forehead for a moment.
You are certain that it was Fever Crumb who shot Flynn?
Fat Shago snorted.
She told me it was this fellow, Vishniak, but I've had our people ask all over Maida, and nobody's heard of any Vishniak arriving here. Anyway, Vigo and his lads told me nobody could have got past them. It must have been the Crumb girl.
Thurtza shook her head and laughed.
And she seemed such a prim and proper little thing. Well, so did you, my dove, when I first asked old Blazy for your hand in marriage, said her husband fondly.
Their house bumped gently against its buffers, down at the garden's foot. Outside their windows, flights of angels blew across the sunset, and small waves crumpled neatly into lace and silver on the sands of their beach, while their servants entered, barefoot, silent, bringing them their supper. Chapter 20. Wings of the Future. It felt strange next morning, waking in that tower. Such a big space, especially to someone used to living in a land barge cabin no bigger than a wardrobe. Fever thought for a moment of her room in the hotel on Rua Penhasco, feeling sad that she had never actually gotten to sleep in it. It was a pity she had paid in advance. But it was hard to feel sad for long, with such a soft, golden, watery light shining through those slices of window and the empty doorway. She could hear the sea breathing softly. Nothing else. When she lifted her head and looked across the room, Arlo's bunk was empty. She stood up, pulled on her shoes, checked that her hair was still tied back tidily. When she stepped outside, the air was all light and wings, a blizzard of angels tumbling past the tower and blowing along the beaches, their shadows racing over the ivied ruins by the quay. Walking westward, Fever climbed over a spur of the cliffs and came down onto a flat expanse of grass divided by low mounds and hummocks looking out across a beach. The sun made a mirror of the wet sand, and Arlo was standing there, naked on his own reflection. He had been swimming, or about to swim, but he had stopped halfway between Fever and the sea to talk to the angels. The big white birds whirled all around him, a white vortex of wings with Arlo as the still point at their centre. He stood with his arms outstretched, and the angels landed on them. Fever watched him bob his head and sway his neck in answer to their swayings and their bobs. She heard the angels softly squawking and chattering, and she guessed that if she went closer, she would be able to hear Arlo making the same sounds. Then one of them saw her, and the whole flock rose in alarm, whirling away over the sea like a bashful tornado. Arlo turned, waved, remembered that he had no clothes on, and hurried awkwardly to where they lay heaped on some nearby rocks. He ran, doubled over, and trying to hide various portions of himself, but Fever could not see what the fuss was about. Did he imagine that she had never studied human anatomy? He hopped about, pulling his trousers on, shrugged on his shirt, and came running up the beach to her, waving two silvery shining things like trophies.
Breakfast! You wondered what we were to eat. I caught these in the old pens.
He stood there holding the fishes out for her to see, grinning foolishly, a little flushed.
Welcome to Casa Thursday, my old family home.
There is no house here, said Fever, and then looked down and saw that the mounds around her, overgrown with wild flowers and grass, marked out the roots of walls, the floor plan of a vanished building.
This is the villa my grandfather built, said Arlo, as if he was still proud of it. Look, here was the atrium, with the entrance hall leading out that way toward the shipyards.
That was the dining room, with the bedrooms beyond.
This place where we are standing was my grandfather's study.
It was extensive, said Fever. He must have been a very wealthy man.
The best shipwright in Maida. Best in the world, probably.
Thanks to his friend, Señor Asora.
Yes. Arlo bounded off across the old walls like a proud householder giving his guest a guided tour. Grandfather kept his pictures here.
He was a great one for paintings. They're some of the things I remember best from when I was little.
I saw one in your house in Maida, said Fever, of your grandfather and Asora and the black poppy.
Yes,
said Arlo again, looking slightly mystified at the way each thing she said turned back to the mysterious Asora.
I recognized him, Fever said.
Who? Grandfather?
No, Asora.
And the ship too, actually.
He travelled all the way to Anchorage aboard the Black Poppy. His real name was Orik Godshawk. He was my grandfather.
Arlo turned and came back toward her, a fish hanging stupidly from either hand.
Really?
You know,
you have a look of him about you, like his picture.
He was Scriven.
One of those Northland mutants, Homo superior.
Well, that's what they called themselves. They weren't really very superior.
Arlo was watching her, and she couldn't guess what he was thinking. She hoped it would not unsettle him to be sharing his island with someone not quite human. He grinned suddenly.
Asora means goshawk in one of the old tongues of Maida. Do you see? It's almost God's hawk.
He laughed.
Fever, this is wonderful. It's fate, a sign from the gods. Your grandfather helped mine build his ships, and now you're here to help me build my aeroplane.
There is no such thing as fate, said Fever sternly, and there are certainly no such things as gods.
But as she followed him back toward the tower, she felt pleased that she had told him about her grandfather. She thought that Orik Godshawk would have been glad that she was here, on Daniel Thursday's island, helping Daniel Thursday's grandson to change the world. For the first few days, she kept expecting trouble. The memory of how fat Jargo Belkin's men had wrenched and tethered her was like a stubborn stain. However hard she tried, she could not shift it. But slowly, in the sunlight and seeming safety of the island, it began to fade a little. The mysterious Lothar Fishniak did not appear, and when Weasel visited the island, he had nothing much to tell them about fat Jargo. Belkin was busy.
Doing business,
he kept telling them. But even Weasel did not come often.
He's found some female in the city,
Arlo guessed, watching him flap back toward the heights of Maida.
Fever stopped sneaking glances from the windows quite so often. When she did, she saw only the empty beaches, the Jenny Hanover moored under the trees at the abandoned quay, and sometimes the Aranya pacing the foreshore like a thoughtful crab, still keeping guard over the Thursday's island and its secrets. On the tower's roof, the flying machine was taking shape again. Arlo seemed so absent-minded sometimes that Fever wondered how he could possibly make sense of the mass of disassembled struts and sections they had dragged up from the schooner. But soon the machine was looking much as it had when she first saw it, except that in the open air it seemed both smaller and more alive. She watched Arlo work at it, using a spokeshave or a rasp to skim off as much as he could from the struts and wing bones, smoothing and shaping them until they were as light and delicate as they could be without losing the strength they would need. Sometimes they worked together at the propeller, smoothing the rough thing he had shaped, working oil into it with a brush before sanding again. Fine sawdust covered them, sticking to the sweat on their sunburned faces, making them sneeze. One hot afternoon, Arlo pulled off his shirt, and Fever saw that his shoulders and chest were as covered with freckles as his face. He stirred deep, unexpected memories in her, of Scriven girls her grandfather had loved, their cowrie shell shoulders and dappled throats. Was that why her grandfather had chosen Daniel Thursday to be his shipwright? Not because of his boat-building skills, but simply on account of all his lovely freckles. Arlo looked up and saw her watching him, and smiled vaguely at her. Then he went back to his work. The star charts of his speckled skin slowly fading under fresh layers of sweat and sawdust. In the evenings the surf boomed along the island's beaches, but in the pens and basins of the old Thursday shipyard the sheltered water grew still as glass, reflecting the peach-coloured sky. A dead tree had washed up on the beach. Arlo chopped it into logs, while Fever gathered dry brushwood from the clifftops and made a fire in the tower's hearth. The fish they caught in the pens and tide pools they spread open like silver books and roasted on a rack that she made from an old window grill. Their oil sizzled, dripping into the hot ash below, and the smell of them was the colour of old terracotta flower pots. When they had eaten, Fever might leaf through Arlo's scruffy notes and drawings while he explained to her the secrets he had learned from the angels. Or they would talk about the next day's work, and then of other inventions they might make, other wonders from the ancient world still waiting to be rediscovered. Then Fever would curl up on one of the stony bunks under a blanket brought up from the schooner and fall asleep, dreaming of flight, and of the machine that waited on the roof above her, tethered to the mountings of the old artillery emplacement, its wings trembling in the night wind. Days went by, days of hard work and sunlight. Soon the frame of the machine was complete. Together, she and Arlo pasted strip upon strip of paper over it, building up the wing surfaces, sculpting the careful asymmetric camber that would give the machine extra lift. As the paste dried, they painted the paper with a solution dizzyingly smelly to strengthen and waterproof it. They attached the control cables that would lift the flaps at the wing's tips and trailing edges to steer the machine up and down, and turn the swallowtail rudder to make it go left or right. Arlo was determined to launch from the tower's top, although Fever was sure that if he could get up enough speed, he would be able to take off from a flat stretch of ground, like one of the island's beaches. But Arlo said he was not going to take the machine apart and carry it all down again, and she had to give in. It was his machine, after all. She suspected his real reason for wanting to launch from the tower was rooted in his memories of watching the angels fly, hurling themselves into the wind from their precarious roosts on the sea cliffs. Fever was happy. Happier now, she thought, than she'd been since she was a little girl, helping Dr. Crumb with his experiments in God's Hawk's Head. She sometimes missed the children and the rest of Lyceum's company, but she knew they would be having a good time in Meriem, and mostly it was a relief not to have to listen to their endless chatter and waste time thinking about ways to light the foolish plays. Here on the island, there was always the feeling, giddy and intoxicating, that she was helping to build the future. The only crack in her happiness was the engine that Arlo expected her to attach to his machine. To someone brought up among engineers, it was a crude-looking thing, an inelegant metal box full of pistons and gears powered by the constant explosion of liquid ethanol lubricated with castor oil. She carefully dismantled and reassembled it, and she could see no reason why it should not work. But it still seemed to her to be much too heavy, although she could see no way that she could make it lighter. Worse still, Arlo had brought with him only one small barrel of fuel. There was not enough to waste any running the engine for long before they mounted it on the frame of the machine. Its first proper test would come when Arlo took to the air. Chapter 21. Lost Maps of the Sky. Sometimes Fever still needed to be alone, and sometimes, too, she sensed that Arlo did not want her company. Then she would go off by herself along the narrow tracks that wound between the pines and dwarf oaks into secret hollows among the rocks on the island's high spine. It was on one of those lonely expeditions that she found the bird castle. At the island's western end stood the remains of a second tower. 500 years before, Maida had been a target for all sorts of sea rovers and sea raiders, corsairs from the Islamist caliphates of old North Africa, roving pirates from Oak Island and strong-walled Dunlochair. The Maidens had had a use for lots of watchtowers. This one was roofless now and tumbled down, and a tangled mass of branches and debris had somehow become wedged in its top. The first few times she saw it, Fever imagined that Arlo's wave had washed right over it and left it clogged with driftwood. But this evening, when she climbed up higher than before onto the summit of one of the rock formations and was looking down at the tower, she started to see that there was a sort of structure to the jutting bulks and branches, and that, in places, they had been woven together like a wicker basket or an enormous bird's nest. She scrambled down off her rock and found a way to the tower through the juniper bushes and low-growing clumps of heather. There was a doorway at the base of it. Nothing left of the door but rusted hinges and a scattering of nails among the nettles that grew on the threshold. She crept inside and looked up. The westering sun slid long needles of orange light through chinks in the walls, lighting up a metal staircase that spiraled through the sagging ceiling. She went up warily, feeling the treads shift as they took her weight. She could hear nothing but the wind-blown bushes outside, rhubarbing like actors in a crowd scene, and far below, the lazy pulse of the surf. The top floor was thick with fish bones and ancient guano. The raggedy mass of old branches overhead formed a roof. A driftwood dome, tied together with rotting rags and ancient straggles of oily rope, with fishermen's floats and old bottles stitched into it here and there. It was clumsy, rank-smelling, crude, probably unsafe. Yet in its way, it was as impressive as any building she had ever seen. And she stood there for a long time just staring up at it. The architecture of angels. A scuffling, a fluttering, and one of the creatures landed beside her.
"Snaxes?"
it asked. Fever was coming to know a few of the angels by sight now. She had often noticed this young female hanging around Arlo's tower, waiting for scraps. "Sorry," she said, spreading her hands out so the angel could see they were empty. "No snacks. I just came to look at this place."
"Old,"
said the angel, hopping away from her, picking up a fish skull with the fingers of one wing. "How old?" asked Fever.
"Yesterday."
"Older than that," thought Fever. "Years and years old." But to the angels, everything that was not happening now had happened yesterday. She asked, "Why don't you live here today?" The angel made no reply. It probably hadn't understood the question. Weasel seemed to be the only one with a vocabulary of more than a few words. Fever left it examining the fish bones and walked across the room to where a gap in the driftwood gave her a view of the western sea. Angels were wheeling whitely around a tall stack offshore. She could make out their nests, crammed together on rock ledges high above the surf. The cliffs beneath them drizzled with long white beards of guano, like frozen waterfalls. She wanted to ask the angel what had made them stop building their bird castles and go back to roosting on cliffs. But there was no point, and she already knew the answer. They had forgotten how, just as people had forgotten how to fly. The sun was sinking quickly. Orange rays tracked through the tower like the beams of spotlights, revealing flurries of scratches on the ancient lime plaster of the walls. There, too, Fever could see order. There was nothing she could read, but there was a rhythm and a reason to the marks that the angels of long ago had made. There were long lines of parallel scorings that might have been tallies of numbers, and in one place, a collection of rough shapes that looked oddly familiar until she recognised them as the outlines of Maida and the Ragged Isles, just as they looked on the maps in Master Persimmon's atlas. "You made charts," she said, crouching down to bring her face closer to the old drawing. It was very detailed. She could see the causeway zigzagging from Maida to the mainland, and the double curve of the harbour wall. Stylized bird forms marked some of the outer islands, perhaps to show which ones were home to angels. She looked to her left along the wall's curve, and there she saw another coastline, with bights and headlands scratched carefully into the paint, and things that might have been fish in the sea. The fish symbols must mark the best fishing grounds, she thought, places way to the west of Maida, out of reach to human fishermen, but well within the range of the angels, gliding on their wide wings. But what was that other shore, so far to westward? "Is this America?" she asked, turning to the bird behind her.
"America,"
said the angel. Did your ancestors, the old angels, did they sometimes fly all the way to America?
America,
said the angel, with its head on one side. It had never heard the word before. It was just mimicking the sound. Then it caught some other sound, the clatter of a kicked stone down below, and took flight, filling the room.